Movies and Booze. I'm Moncrief on News Talk.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. It is indeed time for Movies and Booze. You can get in contact via WhatsApp 087-1400-106. You can send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com or a text to 53106. That will cost you 30 cents. And just in case you were wondering, the person who shot JR was Kristen Shepherd, who was played by Mary Crosby, who, like, really? Barely remember her, or don't remember her at all. But I suppose at the time that was, I remember it was kind of disappointing because everybody hoped it might be a kind of a major type character. Anyway, we are joined by Jean Smullen, Fionnuala Jones and Esther McCarthy. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
Jean, do you remember when JR got shot?
I do, and I remember that. And then I remember when somebody fell asleep and it was all a dream.
Yes, that was later on.
That was later on. That was something
else. To get Bobby back in.
That was to get Bobby back in, yeah. But yeah, I do remember everybody's really, really disappointed because, the plot line, because they couldn't have any of the major guys doing
it. No, because they'd have to get rid of them.
Yeah, and so she was, and I think, wasn't she related to Bing Crosby in some way? I vaguely remember that, or I could be wrong there.
Mary Crosby, could be.
Yeah, I think there was some connection. But anyway, and it was, that was the biggest news. I mean, everyone was glued.
It could have been a war and it would have been less news.
Absolutely. That was, that was like...
Absolutely huge. This is before you were, literally before you were born.
I have no idea what you're talking about, honestly.
Dallas, do you remember there used to be a TV show? Yeah, ask your parents.
I remember the shower thing, but he's like, wakes up, but I didn't know the shooting thing, so there you go.
Yeah, huge thing.
Everyone was glued. Those were the days when families used to sit on couches and watch television together.
I know. Well, I'm glad those days are over.
Yeah, but, me too. And my mother excruciating. Would talk through the whole thing and say, I missed that. What happened there?
My mother would be sitting there like rustling her copy of the Irish Catholic, pretending not to watch, you know, and tutting, but actually watching the whole thing, you know, that kind of a way. Oh, God save us tonight. What wine are we drinking today, Jane?
We've got California, and actually I haven't featured Californian wines for a long, long time. One called Bread and Butter, and it certainly is buttery. It's a Chardonnay and a really great value Bordeaux. It's basic. It's a basic Bordeaux, but by God, it's won so many awards and it really punches way above its weight. So we're looking at California and France today.
Okay, yeah. So I can see that's a 2019 Bordeaux, so that's not bad.
And it's a platinum gold, platinum medal winner in the Decanter Awards. That's mega to do that.
Okay, good for them. Yeah. Right, okay. So Esther has still not with us at the moment. A little bit of a technical whoopsie. I'm getting a finger in a good way. Esther, how are you?
Hi, Sean. How's things?
Oh, my God. You're on a phone. How quaint. Right. So what are the two films we're talking about today?
It's 1992, Sean.
Yeah. Who shot JR, Esther?
Well, this fellow went in for a shower. No, I won't give it all away. My Sailor, My Love. We've got a new Irish cinema this week. I think for the week that's in it. And everyone heading off to the Oscars. And the buzz around the country at the moment of excitement, I think, about our 14 nominees. So we thought we'd look to more Irish films and what's coming next in Irish cinema. So we have My Sailor, My Love, starring the great, great Bree Brennan and James Cosmo, Catherine Walker. This is really good. It's a family-orientated drama about what happens, I suppose, you know, when you know that person in the family who ends up caring for the older relatives. It always seems to come down to one person and the kind of issues and resentment that can sometimes harbour in a family. It looks at that in really interesting ways and really Irish ways, I think, because this man who's been cared for, James Cosmo plays him by his daughter, but Catherine Walker, decides that he's going to up sticks and not go into her plan for a nursing home care for him and embark on actually a romance with his housekeeper. So it's really interesting how this kind of upends the whole aging process and narrative, I suppose. And then we have also got Marlowe, which is Neil Jordan's film, adapted from John Banville's novel written under his pen name Benjamin Black. It was about nearly 10 years ago now, which he channeled the spirit of Philip Marlowe, of course, the character made famous by.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll wow. Okay, so we'll get Esther back and we will be talking to Esther in the next segment of the programme. She'll just be shouting out her window at that point. So, she did mention the Oscars.
Yes.
So, give us a what we know. It's going to be Jimmy Kimmel again, is it?
Yes, he's hosting for the third time. He is going to be addressing last year's slapgate between Will Smith and Chris Rock. That was confirmed this week. There was an executive producer, Molly McNerney.
You see, when they say addressing, is he going to make a heartfelt speech, or is he just going to make a few cheap gags about it?
There's going to be a few gags. I think he said in interviews that, like, obviously we've heard so much material before, but like there's other places they can take it, apparently. I'm kind of over it, but we'll see. One of the executive producers behind the show has said, like, that it is going to be very much a thing of, like, they're going to address it and they're going to move on. Like, they are not going to keep referencing it, so hopefully it'll be up the top and then finish. But what I thought was interesting was, like, the repercussions of it are still being felt with the ceremony. So, like, usually there's a tradition that the previous year's winners for Best Actor and Best Actress present to this year's winners, right?
And Will Smith can't.
Won last year, yeah. But he's banned for the next 10 years, so he can't do it. So there'll be someone else presenting. I don't think we have confirmation on who that is yet. We also have a new carpet this year. It's champagne colour instead of red. Very exciting.
Okay.
I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Rihanna is going to be performing. Someone who isn't is Lady Gaga, even though she's nominated for Best Song. So that kind of makes me feel like she's not going to win. She did the song for Top Gun Maverick that sounds like a lot of goats bleeding at the start, for anyone who has heard it. So it kind of makes me think maybe Rihanna will win. If you've heard the song, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Lady Gaga is obviously filming Joker 2 at the minute, so she's too busy, essentially. Yeah. Someone else who won't be there, Vladimir Zelensky. There was a request put in if he could, like,
address
in whatever and address.
Or maybe he's going to give away the Best Actor.
There you go. There's a gap there. But apparently, so they'd asked to have him there the previous year, and they said no, and they asked again this year, and they were also declined as well, which
seemed to be politicising it,
yeah,
I suppose.
A little bit. And then obviously we had the Oscar Wilde party took place last night, which is like the big shindig for the Irish talent and kind of really kicking things off for us over there. And Colin Cuan was honoured, obviously the first Irish language film ever nominated for an Academy Award for Best International Feature. And then also honoured on the night, we had Kerry Condon, who's obviously up for Banshees of Inisherin, Jessie Buckley, who was previously nominated, but you can see her right now in Women Talking, and Eve Hewson got an award for Best Rising Talent. But someone who hasn't had the best luck on the way over to sunny LA, Barry Keoghan, his luggage was lost on the way over. Ooh. And he was kind of, and usually I roll my eyes when celebs give out about airlines on social media, right? But this is like his first Oscars in which he's nominated, and he was talking about how he packed kind of something sentimental, I think, to wear at the ceremony, but basically his luggage is lost, and he's saying British Airways haven't been very helpful about it. He said he was sent back to LAX. He went to LAX. They were like, we can't help you. So, and as far as I can see, that hasn't been resolved yet. So fingers crossed, someone stuck an air tag in somewhere and it turns up. But
Dunst can fly him out a replacement suit or something like that. You know, you can go in a pair of flip flops.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be short of clothes anyway, yeah. That's for sure.
No, you'd be paying for it. You see, would they get those clothes for free?
Yeah, there's definitely a thing of, like, the designers lend them or whatever, but the way his, I think it was a tweet that he had out, I think he said that, he said, here in LA for the Oscars, and I had tons of sentimental stuff I wanted to wear and bring with me. So I don't know if it's something to do maybe with his son Brando, or, like, his family or whatever, in a way to honour them on the red carpet. You can't replace that stuff, you know what I mean?
God, that's a shame.
So fingers crossed it does turn up.
Yeah, that is a shame. Right, so Jean, tell us about our first wine today.
Right, we're going to go for, the first one is the 2020 Bread and Butter Chardonnay. It retails at €22 and it's in the independent off-licence, so you'll get it in O'Donovan's in Cork, Devaney's in Dundrum, Whelehan Wines in Loughlinstown, Redmond's in Ranelagh, Higgins of Clonsky. So, North America, I've been doing so much work with South America over the years that I don't really, I kind of lost sight of California. The history of North America is very different to the South America, obviously. South America, most of the people making wine originate from the Iberian Peninsula. In North America, it was very, very much broader sort of population. But, I mean, from 1919 to 1933, had prohibition, and that really just scuppered the whole
industry, I imagine. Yes.
Completely, you know. But post 1933, and in the 1970s, people like Francis Ford Coppola, speaking of movies, were the sort of people who actually started to, I suppose, develop the industry in California again. And, you know, he was one of the founding fathers, and there were so many amazing winemakers who developed the industry. Today, 90% of all wines produced in America are produced in California.
Yeah.
So what we have, the difference, the thing about California is a lot of the production is in the Central Valley. And the key areas are Napa, Sonoma, San Luis Obispo, you know, all those kind of premium areas. But a lot of the fruit comes from the Central Valley, where a lot of just industrial farming. This, however, is slightly different. This is a multi-regional blend, this wine, but the wine actually comes from the Sonoma coast, which means it's close to the ocean, and the impact that the ocean has on winemaking in California is quite phenomenal, because you have the cooling breezes coming off, meeting the hot air from the land, and the fog forms, and that brings down, it cools down the vineyards. So anything grown along the coastal region tends to be better in terms of quality. So what we have here is a winery owned by a Bemberg family group. The winemaker is Linda Trotter. This is good fruit. It's all about value for money, and their kind of marketing strategy is don't overthink it. It's just a great glass of wine. And what this is a very classic Chardonnay. It says bread and butter, and one of the characteristics you'll get from Chardonnay is that buttery characteristic when it's aged in wood. And certainly you're getting this now. The other thing about the 2020 vintage, which this wine is, the wildfires, how quickly we forget. That was the first year.
Gosh, yeah.
They had the wildfires in 2019, but they managed to get all the grapes in before it, so there wasn't that much cork smoke taint. But 2020, do you remember there was a whole town that burnt down?
Yeah.
It was really, really dramatic in 2020. So it ended up being a terrible year for the California producers. However, obviously it didn't impact on this wine at all. You know, the wine is fine. What you're getting in this, it's lush and ripe with lots of buttery notes, and if you stick your nose in there, you're just getting that buttery, creamy vanilla just screaming out of the glass. And then when you try it, it's very ripe vanilla bean, almonds, ripe tropical fruit. Dare I say it, a smoky finish, but not.
Yes, I know. It might be tasteless
finish
to say that in
yes,
the circumstances.
Yes. But it's like a really good example. If you like full-bodied, ripe, buttery Chardonnay, then this is one to go for. So Indie Independence, €22. And I mean, I love this style of wine. It's just, this does it for me. So it's a fabulous wine as far as I'm concerned.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief on News Talk.
Is your lover the sort of man to disappear with you as a lover?
Normally they don't disappear easily.
No, I bet they don't. They stay around, climb trellises, scenes in restaurants, lie down on the road, promise you anything. Oh, I know how it goes.
Do you lie down in the road, Mr. Marlowe?
Drink.
There you go. That's Marlowe. Esther, is this just on Sky, or is it going to get a cinematic release?
It's a joint release. It's getting a cinematic release here as well as on Sky and Now. So you're going to see a lot more of this, I think, in the future. I'm seeing it coming through a lot more. Even the likes of Netflix and Prime are doing theatrical releases now as well. I just think their extra revenue, you know, it's like the old days when people brought a movie out in the cinema and then they brought it out in DVD and you bought it for your kids for Christmas. It just kind of makes sense, really, to find the audiences you can where you can, you know.
It's probably all out of copyright now anyway, all the Marlowe stories, so it's kind of appropriated a bit.
Well, I suppose this one is an adaptation of something that was appropriated a bit as well, because it's John Banville's novel, written under the pen name Benjamin Black in 2014. He wrote a novel called The Black-Eyed Blonde. You know, when really famous novelists kind of are, you know, given permission from an estate to kind of revisit a character from a very famous writer, in this case, of course, Raymond Chandler. So, it's Philip Marlowe, but it's less than a decade ago, which is what's interesting about it, I think. It's worth saying as well, like, I think for the weekend that's in it and all the buzz for the Irish at the Oscars, like, there were people that blazed trails, and Neil Jordan's one of them, you know. Won 6 nominations for The Crying Game, and actually, I've got 6 nominations for The Crying Game, and actually won for Best Original Screenplay. Not least, I'd say, for that twist, Sean, do you remember that twist?
Yeah, of course.
It's up there where I see dead people, I think. And I remember actually going to cinema with a few friends, one of them actually falling out of her chair in shock.
It's the most famous Mickey in movie history.
Oh, absolutely. So, so it's worth just revisiting.
Fionnuala
that.
Is now frantically Googling what the hell I'm talking about.
Oh my God, Fionnuala, if you haven't seen it, like, don't Google anything.
Is this set in that era? It's 1930s Hollywood type stuff.
It's set in California, 1939. Yeah. Very noirish. Everyone has nice hats. And was fooling me throughout because I was trying to spot locations. I was going, is that really nice old lift in the Shelburne? I think it is. And there's a lot of it obviously set in Hollywood and very glamorous old school Hollywood. And I went, is that army barracks up in Dublin 8? I think it might be. But they're very good here at disguising. And I had to kind of wait till the end credits to find out that it was actually shot in Ireland partly and in Barcelona partly, which is also doing a very good job at hiding the fact that it's 1930s California. I don't think you could have done it all here. We just don't have the weather to fool people that it's California. But so Mario's in his office and Diane Kruger, who I love on screen, she's always so good. She plays this character called Mrs. Cavendish, who hires him to find. So everyone's in this town is either famous or trying to be famous or hustling or, you know, scamming in some way. It's kind of a wry, takes a wry eye, I think, at the dark side of Hollywood. So she's this rich heiress who has a lover. She has a husband as well, who's a very nasty and aggressive kind of man. And she's wealthy, so she kind of gets to do what she wants. And he's more in love with the drink than anyone else anyway. So she has this lover by the name of Nico Peterson, who has disappeared. And she hires Marlo to take on the case and find out what's going on. So we get to meet a whole heap of characters then, who may have had affairs with him, may have had business dealings with him. At one stage, it's implied maybe that he was involved in a Mexican crime cartel. So he's kind of unraveling all this Marlowe and trying to figure out what's going on. All the while, every woman he meets wants to sleep with him because that's the character he is. And a lot of the action centres around this place called a Cabana Club. It's a kind of glamorous joint that the lovers used to frequent. And then it kind of builds on there and there are kind of tentacles, I suppose, going out then into Mexican crime over the border and what's going on there and whether Peterson was involved in it. So we've got some Irish actors having a blast here as well, including the very glamorous 1930s star Mandy Toxdale, who's played by Shauna Kerslake. She's a very cheeky type she's a full on movie star and she used to hire Peterson as her agent. She describes him interestingly as the kind of man who likes a conquest, not a relationship. And so it does emerge that there are lots of women who know bits and snippets of information about Peterson. So that's kind of where you are here. I think it's the type of material, tone lead, that Neil Jordan can be actually quite good at. I'm a big fan, but I really like his old school melancholy, glamour, sadness films, mostly told through a wry eye. I think he does them really successfully. I think The End of the Affair with Ralph Fiennes and Julianne Moore is probably one of his most underrated films and one of my favourites. So it's going for that kind of vibe here again. And he's surrounded himself with great people, like he's as well as Neeson, Kruger. And you know, Liam Neeson has the sense to have written into his character here a few times as well that he's getting a bit old for this. So it's not like one of these action movies where you're supposed to believe, you know, what clearly is impossible. So when he does take down a couple of people who seem to be wanting to kill him for no apparent reason, he does actually sigh and say, I'm getting a bit old for this. So that kind of works well. And then, you know, you have a great cast. Diane Kruger, I love. Jessica Lange, the legendary Jessica Lange, plays Diane Kruger's mother's character. Super bitchy, wealthy, married to an oil baron, gets what she wants, usually gets what she wants, and tries to ends up trying to pay off Marlowe to kind of take down her daughter in a way. So that's kind of he's really going, what's going on here now, you know? So it also has Colm Meaney in there, and it has a really good screenplay writer as well, like top notch, written for screen by William Monaghan, who wrote the Oscar-winning screenplay for Martin Scorsese's The Departed. So you're in serious territory here. But it doesn't always quite work. And, you know, it's beautiful looking, as you'd expect a Neil Jordan film to be. But it's just, it's almost a bit too laconic in style or something.
Well, I mean, it sounds very much like a bog standard Raymond Chandler story. Now, that's consulting Raymond Chandler stories. You know, that what you described is the sort of thing that happens. There's lots of quips thrown in. There's, you know, it's quite dark. So, like, has either John Banville or Neil Jordan added anything to it?
I mean, I had good company with it, I will say. I think what elevates it, makes it watchable, is the cast. And the jibes and the tit for tat. I felt kind of distanced by the amount of story elements there were to it and how people were talking about other characters. It's very talky, which I don't necessarily dislike at all, but it became a little bit distracting to me that people were talking about other people all the time. But I think as the story builds...
You work in the media. You must be well used to people talking about other people all the time.
Bitching you. But I just think once the action gets off done, more of the story is allowed to unfold on screen, it gets a lot better. I did like this. I will say the majority of the reviews for this have been middling to not great. Okay. Did like it though. I did like it. It's good looking, it's glossy, it's a nice distraction, you know? I did enjoy it for that, yeah.
Ed, who's in Drogheda, says the bar scene in Marlowe was filmed in an Irish pub in Barcelona called the Michael Collins. I was on set for the week and it was an amazing experience. Liam Neeson is a gentleman. So there you go. That's an inventive
use. I've been
in
that pub, actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
In your flip-flops. saying they're Wolf Jones. Going back to the Oscars, someone says Jimmy Kimmel presenting, another reason to not watch the Oscars. Someone else says, so does that mean that Chris Rock gets the slap this year as presenter? lots of people have made a similar suggestion to that. Now, this is intriguing. Bob Odenkirk, I should say, is going to be in a remake of The Room.
Yes.
The Room being, you should briefly explain to people how it's the worst movie of all time.
Yeah, so The Room was made in 2003 by writer-director Tommy Wiseau, like this guy that just had this grand idea of making this kind of romantic drama, but ended up kind of being a comedy because it was so, so bad, and it kind of earned this cult status as like the worst movie in the world, but then it got the success off of that. And people would probably better know it from The Disaster Artist, which came out in 2007, maybe a bit later than that, actually. I could have that wrong. Anyway, with the Franco brothers, and that was very critically acclaimed. Very good movie. If anyone hasn't seen that, it kind of tells the story of why they wanted to do it, and this character of Tommy Wiseau and why he wanted to make this movie.
I think we've interviewed Tommy Wiseau on the show, actually, and he seemed completely oblivious to the fact that anyone thought it was a bad movie.
Yeah, I still don't think he does, but I love that. I would love to live in that level of delusion. Seems like a nice guy. Anyway, as you mentioned, Bob Odenkirk is taking on the lead role of Johnny, which Tommy played in the original, for this remake. So there was reports, and this came out earlier this week, but it's actually for charity. It's from, the production's coming from Acting for a Cause, and it's this organisation that, you know, it teams up with various charitable causes and then ask for donations, and it puts on these like digital performances. Other people who've done it before, like Justice Smith, Zazie Beetz, Julie Fox, Alex Wolff. This particular remake is raising funds for AMFAR, which is a foundation for AIDS research. But Tommy Wiseau didn't know this was happening, apparently. Like, Variety got onto him and he were like, hey, what do you think of Bob Odenkirk and them doing this movie? They had not heard about this at all. Oh. They only heard about it when the first reports came out, so I don't know if that's going to change anything.
Is there a copyright issue?
I don't know, but anyway, no release date as of yet, but I'm very intrigued to see Bob
I am, but
Johnny.
You know what, it's if you deliberately to set out to make a bad film, that's much harder to do than accidentally making a bad film.
That's the thing, I mean. Exactly. And like Bob kind of said on social media, he's like, I tried my best to sell every line, but he just said, he was like, I had so much fun. So
2017 was the disaster.
2017, yes. I knew it at 7.
20 or 7, you were what? Junior infants.
Yeah, but I was a bit off. Yeah, I was a bit off.
And Disney now is like, Disney are basically going to reduce the amount of output.
So they're saying, right? So obviously Disney Plus lost like 2.4 million subscribers in the last 3 months of last year.
Okay.
And it was their kind of first decline since their launch in 2019. Now, Disney as a whole is still making loads of money because of the theme parks and everything else. But yeah, so the Disney CEO, Bob Iger, was like talking this week about how they're kind of redeveloping their business plan for film and TV, and they're kind of going for... they're going for an approach of like quality over quantity, because he was kind of saying that, yeah, there seems to have been a bit of throwing everything at a wall, particularly with some of the franchises. So he said like Marvel's going to still stay under them, obviously, and like Star Wars and Frozen. But he said, so his exact quote was, what we have to look at Marvel is not necessarily the volume of Marvel storytelling, but how many times you go back to the well on certain characters. And he said like sequels obviously do really well for them, but he's kind of asking, do we need to go back for a third or a fourth time? Which I would say, no, we don't.
No, absolutely.
And I'm glad he's listening. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether this is kind of just all talked on, whether it will actually be
But if all the sequels are still making money,
well, that's the thing, and he's even acknowledging it, that it's like they still make boatloads of money for us, like, so.
So he's going to go to the Disney board and say, my proposal is to make less money next year. I'm sure that'll go down really well.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief on News Talk.
One texter says, I haven't seen The Room, but it can't be as bad as The Banshees of Inisherin. I only read that out because I think it's not, wouldn't be a proper Irish send off if he didn't have some bitter words from someone.
What is with The Banshees of Inisherin haters? Just be quiet. Let us have this, please.
No, it's maybe because they didn't quite, you know, if you kind of hear something's fantastic and then you watch it and you go,
I totally get that, and I totally understand that people are like, but I don't, it's not a terrible movie. I absolutely
absolutely
agree with that.
No, it's an excellent movie. But I say I watched Sunscreen, I want to say, but that's
After Sunscreen. Did you not like it?
Not that I didn't like it, but I was left kind of indifferent by it.
I loved it, and there's a lot of talk about him that he could, Paul Mescal could.
That's not to criticise his performance, which was excellent, but it was kind of a bit nothing. You know, it just struck me as a bit nothing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I liked the story behind it, and I thought the young girl is very good. I think she's really better than Paul.
They were very good, but it was like the story was like there was a whole lot of, they left open a lot of gaps, so there's a lot of inference.
Yeah.
That something might be going on, but actually nothing might be going on.
Yeah.
That's kind of what.
And isn't that the beauty of cinema? Interpretation.
Well, it is, but you know. Bit of story wouldn't do any harm. Right, so what wine are we going to drink next?
Our red now, this is from Bordeaux. This is the 2019, and it's called B by Fompadette. And it's 1995, and you'll get it in Baggot Street Wines. You'll get it in Worldwide Wines in Waterford, Drink Store Dublin 7, Neighbourhood Wines, Martins in Fairview, you know, mainly independent off-licence. Now, Chateau Fompadette is located in Aquitaine. North of a small village called Saint-Lambert, and it's owned by the Peroni family, and
the beer people.
No, different, same name probably,
but
different.
You know, be a good night out in Ross.
Anyway, it's run by a girl called Pascal, who took over the running of the estate from her father Pierre. Now they've been making wine in Pouillac since 1700, so like they've got a bit of experience there. But the key to this is just a basic generic Bordeaux, but the vineyards that the family own are located literally next door to some of the greatest wineries in Pouillac, namely Mouton Rothschild, Chateau Latour, Chateau Lynch Bage, Pichon Longueville, the Baron and the Comtesse. So they've got 50 year old vines planted very, very in close proximity to some of the greatest vineyards in the world, and they're making this as a basically ordinary Bordeaux. It's made from a blend of 40% Cabernet Franc, 30% Cabernet Sauvignon, and 30% Merlot. And the 2019 vintage is now shaping up to be brilliant. Right, that was a really, really hot summer. Right, one of the hottest on record overall, but it meant that there was lots of ripe fruit, and it just now looks as if this wine is going to be a huge star, right? So what you have here, the first thing I noticed, just looking at it, it's quite a brown in colour. That means like the development is already showing through, even though it's only a four-year-old wine. And when you smell it on the nose, it has all that classic Bordeaux, the cedar wood, the spice, the jammy fruit. This is benchmark Bordeaux, but this is not one of the great, you know, great wines. This is just an ordinary wine.
Mm, yeah.
And God, the nose is amazing. As I mentioned earlier, it did win a platinum at Decanter, but it also won a silver medal at Concours Mondial de Bruxelles. And this is a fabulous example of entry level Bordeaux. I'll just give you a... Oh God, when you try it, yeah. Gorgeous development.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah,
really
absolutely lovely.
Soft, spicy.
And isn't it funny, as you were saying, like it can be just because your wine is, the grapes are grown down the road from where the really expensive stuff is, and it's a lot of the time just as good.
Yeah,
nowhere nearly as good.
So, like, seriously, snap this up.
Yeah.
Because this is a star. 1995, and it genuinely tastes like a lot more. And that's, you know, that's what everybody wants when they want to bring a wine to a dinner party that they got for a certain price that tastes like it cost a hell of a lot more. And this one certainly does.
Yeah, indeed. Anyway, Fionnuala, we're going to talk about an actress you've heard of, Jean, so brace yourself. Goldie Hawn.
Another one. Oh, we're all on the flashbacks today.
Yeah, on the flashbacks today. But she's been talking about when she was making the musical Chicago with Madonna. Now, was she a producer on it, or what was she? What was her role?
Well, she was a producer and she was due to star in it. So this was 15 years before, like, the Chicago that we know won Best Picture in 2003. But this adaptation was in the works. It was herself and Madonna, as you mentioned. Goldie was supposed to be producing as well. And then Larry Gilbert was on the, Gilbert, I should say, was on the script. And Broadway veteran Marty Richards was also supposed to be producing. But then Harvey Weinstein killed it, cancelled the project, wanted to go with two younger female leads. And she's been talking about it this
week.
How
surprising for her.
I know. Shocker.
It's not like him at all.
Because Goldie was in her 50s at the time. He commissioned a new script and Goldie's character was going to be... the character was 23 years old then. So Hawn went to Harvey Weinstein and was like, don't F with me. We made a deal. So he did end up like paying her for her work. But yeah, never saw the light of day. Just interesting to think what could have been for that project.
Right. What does she think of Harvey Weinstein?
Oh, well, she kind of said, like, she said after, I think there'd been a conversation after it. Now, bear in mind, this is prior to, like, everything else, you know, she kind of admired the fact that he did come back and stuck to his word. And then she was like, little did I know, but also said now that he's fully living his karma. So she's not like, don't worry, she's not like a Harvey Weinstein apologist.
Okay.
But
yeah,
just reflecting and was talking about her own experience of when she won the Oscar when she was 24 and wasn't there for the ceremony as well. She was filming in the UK at the time, I think. She didn't think she was going to win, so she was like asleep when she won.
I know, that's mad, isn't
it? And she kind of, it's one of her regrets now. She was like,
but that was 1960 something.
Yeah.
Crikey, she was only a child at the time.
24 years old.
24 years old.
First
oh
Oscar.
My god. Right. Another actress you've heard of, Jean. Sharon Stone.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is really
my
sad.
It looks brilliant, by the way.
Oh, yeah, it looks fantastic. Oh, I never knew about this. This is really sad because of that particular scene. She lost her son.
Yes. The scene in Basic Instinct. She's been talking about it this week. She said that judicial prejudice caused her to lose custody of her son over that scene, as you said. She was speaking on the Table for Two podcast and she alleges that the role was kind of... And she's talked about this a lot because her memoir came out last year as well, and basically said the role was weaponized against her. She said, I lost custody of my child when the judge asked my child, my tiny little boy, do you know your mother makes sex movies? Like this kind of abuse by the system.
Wow.
That I was considered what kind of parent I was because I made that movie. And she made the point, rightly so, that you have shows now where people are like regularly like very naked and like very, you know, like it's nearly part of the content, whereas this was like a very passing scene.
It was a thriller, and it was a very good thriller, Basic Instinct. And I mean that kind of that scene was almost it was I don't know what it was there for, to be honest with you, but it was actually a great film.
Well, she maintained that she was also, and she says this in her memoir, that she was kind of duped into filming that she didn't realise she was going to be, you know, exposing herself in that way. Now the director denies it and said that she that she knew it was happening. But yeah, very sad, very very sad.
Yeah.
She's kind of having a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a second act. Like she was on SNL recently when Sam Smith was performing, and yeah, but it would never happen now, I don't think, or there would be much wider discussion about it now, for sure.
Absolutely,
but it wouldn't cause the same furore.
That's what I mean, 100%.
No.
No.
Going back to talking about The Room, Peter in Strandhill in Sligo says, we're running a shite night at our house every Sunday where we play bad movies. The Room only scored third, with Fatal Deviation, an Irish kung fu movie, in second place, and Blackbird streaks ahead in first place as the worst movie ever. All totally entertaining, though. We go up to Breeze Pub in Strandhill to discuss over pints and pizzas, says Peter. That
sounds Can I come next time,
please? Yeah, that sounds like a great night, Peter. We'll do it, and it will be from your house at some stage. Right, we'll go on to our second movie of the day. It is My Sailor, My Love. Here's a clip.
Ah, right, that's enough. You'll have me in the morgue.
Where's the old folks home?
What's an old folks?
It's like a place you can leave old people when they get too old. Or maybe your family's gonna want to go on holidays or something.
Like with a dog?
Yeah, sort of like with a dog.
Even if they don't need to leave.
Oh. Howard! Jesus!
Sounds like a road safety advert. Right, so what's the premise here, Esther?
The premise is, it's kind of about this older couple who embark on a complicated romance and what that does to his responsible daughter, who's used to being carer and has fallen very much into the pattern of feeling like she's given up a lot of sacrifice in her life, and she's quite kind of bitter about it. She's played by Catherine Walker, a really, really good performance from Catherine Walker here, actually. And it's about that dynamic between families. Her dad is played by James Cosmo, and he's this kind of really kind of, he's a very dynamic but very difficult man. Mm-hmm. Charismatic but cranky. And we first see her visiting his house, and the house is filthy. It's an absolute state, like. So she kind of insists that he must get a housekeeper, and she puts up an ad locally, and Bree Brennan steps into the market up for the job, and he kind of tries to push her away at the start because he's very afraid, I suppose, for reasons that are revealed quite later in the film, of the lack of the loss of his independence and the potential further loss of his independence. So he kind of pushes her away first, but Bree Brennan's not for pushing, and she's great here. And she kind of walks off and says, well, you figure it all out then. And he realises actually he needs her more than he likes to admit. So I think then the power dynamic between them becomes a bit more equal, and they start to share this bond. It's kind of initially driven by a need for companionship, but he just becomes transformed, this character, through the course of the film, because he just falls in love with her and her family. When he discovers that the daughter is planning to put him into a care facility, he actually says, why don't you move in and live with me, so she can't get away with doing this. So it's a very, very good film, this, in cinemas today, released by Wildcard Distribution. Like a lot of Irish movies being made at the moment, Sean, it's a co-production, in this case with Finland. And it's a Finnish filmmaker by the name of Klaus Harrow. So he brings that kind of Scandinavian noirish kind of eye to the whole thing. And it's helped very much by the fact that, believe it or not, in the summer of 2021, when Jenny the Donkey was acting like a right diva up in Achill, demanding more than the stars of the film, another Irish film was also in production on Achill Island.
Ah, right, because I did interview a woman who was an extra on The Banshees, and she said that she was with a group of extras. Some of them worked on Banshees and then just crossed over to the other side of the island to work on the other film. This is the one.
I heard her, actually. She was great fun.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah. So this is the one. So Achill, or as we should call it now, probably Hollywood, hosted two great Irish movies, I think, in the summer of 2021. I really, really liked this. It's dark, but it's never grim, and it rewards you with really good character-driven stuff. I liked this a lot, I have to say. It's very good. And just like McDonagh, the island looks absolutely spectacular up on screen.
Okay, that's good to
know. In just a slightly more Scandi way. It's really interesting to see. I know Banshees is obviously a period film, but it's really interesting to see two different sets of eyes on the same locations and some landscapes and how different they can look. I think McDonagh's film was all rainbows, wasn't it? He said in interviews he just wanted the place to look as beautiful as it could be. And the clouds are a bit grayer now in this one.
It's a Scandi film. Of course it is. Yeah. All right, okay, that sounds like a good one. Jean, before we go, a few people wanting you to mention the name of the red wine you were talking about today.
Have it straight here. It's called Be by Fon Badet. Fonbadet. It's 2019. It's 1995. Like Blackrock Cellar, Baggot Street Wines, Devonies of Dundrum, Sweeney's, the Grapevine in Glasnevin, the Vintry in Rathgar. It's most of the independent off license have it, and it's absolutely super.
Right, and Jean Smolin did text a picture of those two wines earlier on or tweet a picture of those two wines,
Insta,
I should say.
As well.
On one Insta as well. Oh, very modern altogether. Right, okay, I'll let Jean go out taking pills and clubbing later on. Thanks to Fionnuala, Esther and Jean.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief on News Talk.